Welcome to the Bone Coach Show, dedicated to helping you understand all things related to diet, lifestyle, bone health, and how you can live and thrive with low bone density and osteoporosis. I'm your host, Kevin Ellis, certified health coach, health and wellness speaker, and above all else, your bone coach. After being diagnosed with osteoporosis in my early 30s, I transformed my health through diet and lifestyle and now help my clients and community members do the same through my online coaching practice, BoneCoach.com. Look, there are no quick and easy cures for low bone density, but the choices we make every single day can have a powerful impact on our bones, our health, and our general well-being. I'll share the research, interview the experts, and help you figure out how to get the conditions right in your body so you can better your bones through diet and lifestyle. Short disclaimer, I'm not a medical doctor and this show should not be considered medical advice. Always consult with your healthcare team before making medical decisions and changes to your diet and lifestyle. With that being said, let's get on with the show.
There are lots of genes that we have identified. Some of them specifically put you at increased risk for breast cancer, like the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes. These are actually tumor suppressor genes. So if you're born with two normal copies of these, your chances of getting cancer are decreased. And it's people who are born without one copy, or they're born with a copy, but something happens to that gene along the way. Because it's a tumor suppressor gene, these people that have mutations in this gene are more likely to get breast cancer. But your genes are only a small part of the picture. So even with the BRCA1 and BRCA2 population, their risk of getting breast cancer is around 84%. Which means that something else is in play, because 16% of them are not getting breast cancer. And that thing that's in play, that's your environment.
If you haven't done so already, especially if you're newly diagnosed with osteopenia or osteoporosis, or if your most recent bone density scan still showed more bone loss, go ahead and pause this episode and head over to bonecoach.com to sign up for your free 7-day osteoporosis kickstart guide. That's going to give you everything you need step by step by step over the next 7 days to get on the path to improvement and stronger bones. You won't want to miss that. So pause this right now, head over to bonecoach.com, and I'll be here as soon as you get back. Welcome to this episode of the Bone Coach Show. Joining us today to explore breast cancer and bone health is Dr. Jen Simmons. Dr. Jen Simmons is a breast cancer surgeon turned functional medicine physician. Her experience as a patient in 2017 led her to functional medicine. Now, instead of cutting out tumors, she ushers women through their breast cancer journey and empowers them to achieve the best health of their life despite their diagnosis. Dr. Jen, it's great to have you here. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited. I've been really looking forward to this conversation.
Me too. This is going to be great. So let's talk about your background, your story, how you got into this field of breast cancer and helping all these people.
Yeah, absolutely. So there actually wasn't a time in my life that I didn't know about breast cancer. So there was a singer-songwriter in the 1970s and 1980s. Her name was Linda Creed. Linda was the queen of Motown sound in Philadelphia. She wrote all the music for the Spinners and the Stylistics. She actually wrote 54 hits in all. Her most famous song was The Greatest Love of All. So she was literally a rock star, larger than life, and my first cousin. So she wrote The Greatest Love of All in 1977 as the title track to the movie The Greatest, starring Muhammad Ali. But it actually received its acclaim when Whitney Houston re-released that song in March of 1986. And at that time, it would spend 14 weeks as the number one song on the charts. Except that Linda would never know that, because Linda died of metastatic breast cancer 1 month after that song was released. I was 16 years old at the time, and my hero died. And Linda's life, and ultimately her death, gave birth to my life's purpose. I did the only thing I knew how to do to prevent women and families from having to go through what my family went through. So I went to medical school. I became a doctor. I became a surgeon. I was the first fellowship trained breast surgeon in Philadelphia. Say that five times twice fast. And I was really like doing novel things that no one else was doing. And I really thought that I was making a huge contribution. Like I thought that I was finding a silver lining and I was doing oncoplastic surgery and really, you know, asking women up front, what is it that you don't like about your breast? Let's correct it in the course of your treatment. And I really did think that I was making a huge contribution. And I did that for about 15 years. So here I am, like at the top of my game. People are coming from all over for me to treat them. And I'm running my practice and the cancer program for my hospital. And I'm a wife and a mother and a stepmother and an athlete and a philanthropist. And I like have all these balls in the air and I think I'm an expert juggler. And one day I go from being able to do everything to being able to do nothing at all. I could not walk across a room without being short of breath, without having palpitations, without really, like I was on the tennis court one day and I would typically play 3 hours of tennis and ask who else wants to hit. And so I'm warming up and I start to have palpitations, can't catch my breath, feel this huge pressure in my chest. And I'm like, oh, this is what a heart attack feels like. And I sit down, I calm down, I drive to the hospital and I spend the next 3 days exhausting in exhaustive testing. So I'm sitting there in the office of my friend and colleague, but doctor, and he tells me that I have Graves' disease and then I need to have surgery and chemo radiation. And I fully appreciate the irony that these are the things that I recommend to people all day, every day, without hesitation or reservation. And the words are coming at me, and I feel like I'm in Charlie Brown's classroom, like wah, 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 wah. And, you know, here I am steeped in traditional medicine. I mean, I am following the standard of care every single day. I'm living by it. I'm running a cancer program. And something said to me, no, this is not right. This is not right for you. It's not the right path for you. And so I kind of leave and refuse treatment. He thinks I've lost my mind, tells me I'm going to die, because that's how most physicians respond when you say no to their treatment. And I started to do some investigation, started to figure out how I could heal myself. And I knew as a traditionally trained doctor that I thought I knew enough about nutrition and nourishment. I wasn't overweight, so I thought I knew what I needed to know. But I went to Dr. Google, of course, what I tell everyone not to do, but I went to Dr. Google, and again and again and again, I'm typing in, how do I heal my thyroid? And I'm getting out, diet, 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 diet. So I figured there must be some more for me to know. So I enroll in the Institute for Integrative Nutrition, which is like a coaching certificate program. So I'm a doctor for like 20 years at this point. So I take my total snooty booty self to this program. So like so hesitant that it's so convinced that I'm probably not going to get anything out of it, right? So I'm sitting there, it's one of the first lectures, and a man named Mark Hyman comes on the stage. So he introduces himself as a functional medicine physician. And I'm sitting there and I say, there's no such thing as a functional medicine physician. What is this quack talking about, right? But I decide that, you know, I need to check my ego at the door. Not for nothing, but I did pay a lot of money to be here. And like, I ought to get the most out of it that I can get. So I kind of shut up and listen. And within 5 minutes of Mark Hyman speaking, my entire world makes sense. And I know that the reason that I got sick was so that I could be in that room in that chair on that day to listen to him speak, because my calling, my purpose in life was to not only help that woman in that one particular way by operating on her, but in fact, I can help generations of women recover from breast cancer and prevent breast cancer and all the things that go along with it. Because in surgery, when I was a surgeon, I was completely focused on the tumor. But the tumor's not the problem. And like everything else in traditional medicine, they're focused on the symptom and they ignore why the symptom is there. So by my focusing on the tumor, I was only helping people to go from point A to point B, but I wasn't changing the trajectory of their life. I wasn't improving their health because I was never addressing why they got breast cancer in the first place. And by addressing the root causes of breast cancer, not only do you help that person and her family, but you help her community, and you can help so many more people because you don't need a one-on-one interaction. You just need to educate. You just need to help people to know why there is dysfunction so that they can create function and optimal function. Because ultimately, as you and I know, health is not the absence of disease. Health is optimum function. And we can help people to get there. So much to my husband's dismay, I quit my job as a surgeon, walked away, and trained in functional medicine, opened up Real Health MD. And now I help people anywhere along that breast cancer journey, from the previvors to people with metastatic disease. And I help them to recover their health and enjoy the best health of their life despite their diagnosis.
That is an amazing story. And it's always great to hear somebody who kind of goes on this journey, makes all these, like you find some people that have been really helpful. Maybe you got some certain education, and then you just have this epiphany where you're like, you know what, this is what I have to do. This is what I'm supposed to be doing. And I'm glad it all made sense for you, because now you're helping so many people. And I know breast cancer is such an important issue. So many women are affected by this. Let's talk about what causes.
And men too. I get in trouble when I don't acknowledge the men. So I'll say that, and men too. And I have,
of course,
I've treated it. They say it's about 1 in 1,000. And I've probably treated 5,000 people for breast cancer while I was a surgeon, and 5 of them were men. So yeah, that's about it. 1 in 1,000. So I'm not forgetting about the men.
Absolutely not. So then what causes breast cancer? Let's talk about that.
Yeah. So let's first talk about what is breast cancer, right? Because breast cancer is not a bad breast, right? You don't get breast cancer because your breast is bad. Breast cancer is a systemic disease and is a normal response to an abnormal environment. And we are living in an environment now that is toxic. And it's very easy for that external environment to influence our internal environment. And there are certain organs, like the breast, like the thyroid, that are especially sensitive to disturbances in that environment, which is why breast cancer is so common, and so much more common than other kinds of cancers, because the breast is kind of sensitive. And there are so many chemicals in our environment that mimic estrogen in a very non-productive, toxic way. So I think we'll get to talking about this later, but just from a perspective of, does estrogen cause breast cancer? The answer is a resounding no. And anyone who looks at the breast cancer data, like, it's inarguable, because if estrogen were the problem, when do we see breast cancers? We see them in the postmenopausal population when estrogen is basically all but depleted. You know, we have such nominal amounts of estrogen in the postmenopausal state. So in the premenopausal state, and especially like think about pregnancy, that's a time when estrogen is so prevalent, but not that we don't see any breast cancers during pregnancy, but it is a minute fraction of pregnant people that are diagnosed with breast cancer. So breast cancer is just a sign, for lack of a better word, of some kind of systemic imbalance, disturbance, whatever you want to call it. You have exceeded your body's ability to clear whatever toxin that is, such that the chemistry of the breast makes those breast cells think that they're not safe and they go into survival mode. And the same way that you can create that toxic environment, you can reverse that toxic environment. And once you do that and the breast cells feel safe again, there's no reason for them to go into this kind of survival mode where they're just growing, reproducing, growing, reproducing, growing, reproducing, right? And so it is about identifying where that imbalance is coming from for you, and then doing whatever you can do to reverse that kind of situation.
And are there some people that are maybe more likely to, you know, develop breast cancer?
For sure, absolutely. So, you know, when you look at people, everyone has a different ability to clear the toxins, right? So one thing that's really prevalent right now is mold, right? So mold is basically ubiquitous. It's everywhere. Some people have the enzymes to break down mold and they're not affected by it. Other people can walk into a moldy room and know immediately they have a headache. They feel awful, right? Those are the 25% of people that lack those enzymes to clear mold. Now, if you're someone who lacks those enzymes to clear mold, and yet you were exposed to mold on a chronic basis, guess what's going to happen? You're going to become chronically inflamed. Chronic inflammation has all kinds of ways that it presents itself. So it can manifest as heart disease. It can manifest as anxiety or depression. It can manifest as bone disease, as bone loss, as osteoarthritis, or even rheumatoid arthritis, right? Like it can manifest in all of these different ways, and it can manifest as breast cancer. So there are all these environmental things that can contribute to a breast cancer diagnosis. To some extent, it is the perfect storm. So oftentimes we see people who were doing fine, and then they have some major thing happened to them, like a divorce or a death or a move, or, you know, sometimes these are joyous things that are very stressful. So you can have a very stressful pregnancy, and that can be a really inflammatory condition for you. And so there are all of these environmental things that can cause inflammation, and the key to preventing disease and reversing disease is to eliminate these inflammatory triggers.
Anything else from maybe at the genetic, you know, level, like any specific genes that can affect?
Absolutely. So there are lots of genes that we have identified. Some of them specifically put you at increased risk for breast cancer, like the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes. These are actually tumor suppressor genes. So if you're born with two normal copies of these, your chances of getting cancer are decreased. And it's people who are born without one copy, or they're born with a copy, but something happens to that gene along the way. These because it's a tumor suppressor gene, these people that have mutations in this gene are more likely to get breast cancer. But your genes are only a small part of the picture. So even with the BRCA1 and BRCA2 population, their risk of getting breast cancer is around 84%, which means that something else is in play, right? Because 16% of them are not getting breast cancer. And that thing that's in play, that's your environment. And so, do people who have a BRCA mutation have to be more vigilant than most? Yeah, they're walking the line for sure. But it's not the only thing, right? So your genes may load the gun, but your environment pulls the trigger. And that's the hopeful part, because that's the part that we have a lot of control over. We don't have total control, but we have a lot of control. And there are a lot of choices that you can make to determine whether or not this is going to affect you. And you know, one of the things that I talk about so much that we often don't think about is, you know, toxins come in all different forms. So everyone can realize that mold is a toxin. People can realize that plastics are a toxin. People can realize that pesticides and herbicides and fungicides, they can realize that they are a toxin. They often don't realize that antibiotics are a toxin. But what they really don't realize is like relationships can be really toxic. And they, even though it doesn't seem like you're taking it in, you're taking it in. And it's having profound effects on your equilibrium, on your internal chemistry. And you can actually measure these things. You can measure markers of inflammation. And after you have an argument or something like that, these markers of inflammation are up. And so, even though they're intangible, there are so many things that go towards creating this imbalance. And it's really about changing from the chemistry of stress to the chemistry of joy. And we can all do that. You know, for most of us, this is a choice. Now, granted, like there were times in history, like the Holocaust, you know, it's very hard to create joy in those situations, but most of us are not in that situation, and we're certainly not in it all the time. So there's so much that we can choose. And remembering that what you think about grows. So we need to be really intentional about what we want to grow. Because if all you can see, if all that you can focus on is your disease, you betcha that's what you're going to get. You're going to get more disease. You're going to get more dysfunction. But if you can see past that and focus instead on joy, on gratitude, this goes a very long way towards health promotion. And so your mindset ends up being tremendously important in all of this.
I love that. And I know at the beginning of this, you mentioned estrogen does not cause cancer,
Yeah.
but a lot of people believe that to be the case.
I
Can we
know.
talk about why people
For
may
sure.
believe that estrogen causes cancer?
Yeah. So it's twofold. The first is that when we look at cancers under the microscope, many of them have an increase in the number of estrogen receptors sitting on their surface. So, a normal breast cell, if you will, is going to have estrogen receptors. Most cells in the body have estrogen receptors. We have estrogen receptors everywhere. It speaks to how important estrogen is, right? Cancer cells are mutated cells. They have changes to them that make them less susceptible to destruction, right? They just want to survive. They're in survival mode. And so for some of these cells, they upregulate the estrogen receptor. They put more receptors on their surface so that they can use the estrogen that's around in order to reproduce and grow and continue to survive. Now, it's a little like which came first, the chicken or the egg, but they didn't upregulate their receptor because of the estrogen, right? Like, we don't make bad estrogen. Now, there are a lot of xenoestrogens in our society. So xenoestrogens are chemicals that look and act like estrogen, but not exactly. So when an estrogen molecule sits on the estrogen receptor, it does what it's supposed to do. It dissociates from the receptor, and then the body metabolizes it and we get rid of it, right? Some people are not great metabolizers, and that may contribute to some people's disease, but let's just assume that you're a normal estrogen metabolizer. Okay, so that's what happens. Estrogen does what it's supposed to do. It is very, very important in all kinds of functions all over our body. Now, there are things that act like estrogen, look like estrogen in our environment, but not exactly. So things like plastics, things like antibiotics, things like fragrance, things like herbicides, fungicides, pesticides, glyphosate, PCAs, PCBs, all phthalates, all of these things that we are regularly encountering in our food, in the products that we put on our skin, in our air, they are ubiquitous and everywhere. And so they look kind of like estrogen, but not exactly. So then they go and they sit on that receptor and they stimulate the cell, but they can't come off. They're stuck, right? Because they're not exactly estrogen. And so they overstimulate the cell. So it's these xenoestrogens in our environment that are only getting more numerous every single day, only getting more numerous. I think the number of chemicals that are allowed in our food and in our products is like, I don't know, it's some crazy number, 100,000. 1,000 of which have been tested, and they've only been tested alone, not in conjunction with one another, not in combination with one another. So we have no idea how safe or how dangerous these things are. Most of them are dangerous. So when we see numbers of cancer creeping up, our estrogen hasn't changed in all these years, in thousands and thousands and thousands of years. It's not our estrogen that's causing these cancers. It's all of these external estrogens that are causing these cancers. So the first reason that people associate estrogen with breast cancer is because breast cancers have estrogen receptors on them. No one talks about the fact that normal breast cells also have estrogen receptors on them. Now, the second reason is that in 2002, there was a study called the Women's Health Initiative. It was the largest study of its kind. And we were told that it was a study of healthy postmenopausal women, healthy postmenopausal women. And they were randomized to getting hormone replacement, not getting hormone replacement. And 2 years into the study was halted. And we were told, so this was 2003. We were told that there was an increased incidence of breast cancer in the estrogen progestin combination hormone replacement group, and that hormone replacement is dangerous. It causes breast cancer, and no one should have it, right? I finished fellowship in 2003. What do you think was hammered into my brain, right? I was told, and I had no reason to suspect or believe otherwise, that this was a valid study and that hormone replacement is dangerous across the board and that no one should have it, and especially no one who has ever had breast cancer. So, what was born out of that study? Generations of women who have suffered absolutely suffered. Their brain suffers, their heart suffers, their bones suffered. And guess what we didn't do? We didn't lower the breast cancer incidence, right? So the breast cancer incidence is the same. Everyone's suffering, and more people are dying of heart disease because they're missing all of the protective effects of hormone replacement. So fast forward 20 years, they say, we might have been wrong. We came to an unsubstantiated conclusion. Never mind. Use your best judgment, right? Well, the problem is, first of all, I don't think anyone read the retraction. And you have 20 years of learning that people have to unlearn. And doctors may be thought of as critical thinkers, but the truth is that critical thinking ended for the vast majority of them once they got into medical school. Once they got into medical school, they accepted what they were taught as truth, as unquestionable truth, and went about their careers. And so, you know, we have generations of doctors that don't believe in hormone replacement and generations of women that have suffered as a result.
And as we're speaking about hormones too, and hormonal health, how important is hormone health and how are things different in the under 50 population versus the over 50 population?
Yeah. Hormone health, because we have estrogen receptors everywhere in our body, and because you cannot have a healthy brain, a healthy heart, healthy blood vessels, healthy skin, healthy breasts, healthy anything, you cannot have them without hormones. It just doesn't work, right? And what you need for hormonal health is a little different in the pre-50 population than it is in the post-50 population. So in the pre-50 population, you know, if you're maintaining a normal weight and you're moving and you're working on stress management and you're getting nourishing sleep and you're avoiding toxins in as much as you can, you probably have pretty good hormonal health. As you cross over and you get to the perimenopausal, menopausal range, things significantly change. So your ability to extract and use protein changes significantly. And you absolutely, everyone across the board has to up their protein in order to have hormonal health on the other side. You also have to up your protein to have metabolic health. And it's harder to have metabolic health after 50 than it is before 50. And metabolic health is very tied to hormonal health. And then the way that you move really matters. So women under 50 can get away with much more cardiovascular exercise and much less weight-bearing exercise. But as you cross over, that whole protein utilization and need for weight-bearing exercise at the expense of cardiovascular exercise needs to happen. You need to have a shift. And I think so many people get conditioned into the, oh, I just have to move, I just have to move, I just have to move. And the way that you move really matters. And in order to have bone health, especially, you need to make sure that you are incorporating that weight-bearing exercise. And it has to be at least as much as, if not more than, the cardiovascular work that you're doing.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely agree with this. You have to incorporate the weight-bearing, the resistance training. Those are so, so important.
Yeah, and the balance to maintain that mind-body connection. And, you know, the body is one of those things. Like, if you don't move it, you lose it. And that Exercise, and specifically weight bearing and balance exercise, is the very best thing that you can do to prevent dementia and Alzheimer's. And we just don't talk about this enough. We just don't. And people think that, they're doing their word games and that's going to stave off memory deficits and dementia. And the truth is that you're so much better off doing weight training and balance work in order to prevent dementia.
I want to make sure we talk about these, like the treatments for breast cancer too. Like, what are the standard treatments for breast cancer? What impact do they have on our bone health too?
The treatments for breast cancer are actually a huge problem in terms of bone health. And the standard treatments for breast cancer are surgery to remove the tumor, radiation, unless you have the entire breast removed, and some kind of chemotherapy. And that may or may not include some anti-hormonal therapy. So let's break them down. I don't think that surgery really has a tremendous impact on long-term health, but radiation certainly does. Radiation will change the quality of the breast tissue, but more importantly, radiation will affect heart health when it's on the left-hand side. It will accelerate cardiovascular disease, and it also causes direct fragility to rib fractures. I mean, to the ribs, and makes people vulnerable to rib fractures from minor trauma. So like not a fall, not a major trauma, like minor trauma, like a cough or a sneeze. And I don't know if you've looked at the data on rib fractures, but the death rate from a rib fracture is not insignificant because people can get a direct injury to the lung. And rib fractures are often associated with pneumonia because they're so painful that people underventilate and end up getting a collection of secretions, which then get infected. And pneumonia is not, there's a significant threat to life with pneumonia. We just saw what years of that looks like, right? So radiation is a problem for those reasons. Chemotherapy is a huge problem. Chemotherapy accelerates bone loss. It accelerates heart disease. It accelerates dementia. And the vast majority of women who get breast cancer, certainly early breast cancers, they're not dying of breast cancer. They're dying of heart disease. They're dying of dementia. They're dying of pathologic fractures, right? And we're creating this. We are creating this. And then the hormone depletion that goes on with chemotherapy and with the treatment. I mean, in a lot of women with hormone positive cancers, they are intentionally depleting their hormone production. And this accelerates aging across the board. Accelerates aging. And, for some people, it's absolutely necessary, but we're also over-treating tons of women, over-treating them significantly. And this is because we don't currently have a way to distinguish who does and who doesn't need treatment. So we're doing massive mammographic screening, which we're radiating people and causing some of these breast cancers as a result. And we're finding these cancers. The second you get that diagnosis, you're getting treated and you're getting the gamut of treatment. And we don't know if these would become clinically relevant or not. The vast majority probably wouldn't. And yet we're treating all of these people and we're accelerating aging in all of them. So what we really need is a test to determine who needs to be treated and who doesn't. Who can get away with just a lumpectomy? Who doesn't need to be treated at all? Who just can get away with observation? And so until we do that, we're really not serving people. We're really not. And we are accelerating disease and we're significantly affecting their quality of life. You know, women without estrogen are miserable. You can't sleep. You have no libido. You're having problems in your relationship and you have aches and pains. I mean, how many women come to you and their major complaint is that they feel awful, like everything in their body hurts. It's a terrible way to live, to be in pain all the time. And we're causing that. We're causing that. And it's terrible.
And maybe what are some, as we go through the treatments, what are some proactive things that people can do? Or, you know, after they find out, and obviously if you're listening to this and you currently have breast cancer, you're on medications or something like that, obviously consult with your physicians and things before you jump into or stop doing anything.
Yes, but please don't take this as your own personal medical advice. We are having an educational conversation and everyone needs to see their doctor and make sure that they are making the right decision for them. But there is so much that you can do to proactively change. First of all, you can ask the questions, right? Why do I need this? How is this going to help me? How is this going to hurt me? Right? So we need to ask all of these questions. And then in addition to a treatment plan, and this is true for everything, I don't care what diagnosis you have, everyone who has a treatment plan needs a health plan. And that health plan should include what, how, and when you should eat, right? And I advocate for a whole food, plant-based, low to no grain diet that includes healthy fats and promotes a low glycemic result. But, you know, there is not one way for anyone to eat, and you need to arrive at the right diet for you. And the way that you know that you're there is you feel great and you're at your optimum weight, right? And so that's going to be a little different for everyone, but everyone needs to find that sweet spot for them, right?
Can we touch on too, like maybe how you arrived at that was the one, the dietary approach that you felt fit the best and maybe that the research, when you were doing the research.
Yeah. So when you look at any like cancer prevention diet, every single one, the less animal protein you have, the better you do. So, you know, I don't talk about being a vegan because that's a political movement and not a dietary choice, right? But I don't tell people to be 100% plants. I tell people to be plant-based because that is where the phytonutrients are. But I'm very careful to say whole food plant-based because Twizzlers are vegan. Twizzlers have no nutritional benefit. Now, the reason that I don't advocate for grains is because, first of all, grains are the seeds of grasses, and grasses are consumed by ruminators. They have a very long digestive tract, and they really spend hours working the nutrient out of the grass. We do not have a digestive tract like that. So most people, most humans do not do well with grains. In addition, grains, most of them, even when you're eating whole grains, have a higher glycemic index. I am trying to lower blood sugar, lower insulin, therefore lower insulin-like growth factor so as to not promote tumor growth. And the third reason is because when you eliminate grains, you also eliminate a significant chemical burden. Because even if your grains are grown organically, they're probably next to a farm that is not. And so there's spray runoff, there's water runoff. And so most people notice a significant improvement in their health when they pull grains out. And also when you pull grains out, like, you know, everyone's tempted to eat processed food. So when you pull grains out, there's a, you know, you're removing a large temptation. So that's kind of my gestalt as to why I advocate for a grain-free diet. But if you're someone who doesn't have a weight problem and you don't have active cancer, you probably don't need to do that. But remember that we have no nutritional need for grains, none. And if we never ate another grain again, we would suffer no nutritional deficit. I have to think that means something. Like, if we were meant to eat that, wouldn't we need it? Right? So that's just what resonates with me, that if there's no benefit to doing it, I don't include it.
I love that we're talking about this. And you and I mean, we fit this podcast interview into our tight schedules. We might have to, and we're both getting ready to hop off here in a couple minutes, because we do have hard stops, but we might have to do a part two also on this.
Yeah.
But this was super interesting. And I want to make sure we let everybody know where they can find you at, also, Dr. Jen Simmons, if we can.
Yeah. So if you are looking for help on your breast cancer journey, please head to realhealthmd.com. That's my website. You can follow me on social media, Dr. Jen Simmons. I'm trying to put good stuff out there every day for people to incorporate into their life. And if you think that plant-based living is not delicious and satisfying, you can download my cookbook, Recipes for Real Health. It's a plant-based guide to living deliciously. And prove me wrong. Just prove me wrong, because plant-based eating can be delicious. It can be gourmet. It can be fantastic. It can be simple. But what it is nourishing. And that's really what we're trying to do. At the end of the day, we're trying to feed everyone what they need. We're trying to feed their gut. We're trying to feed their soul. We're trying to feed their body. We're trying to feed their emotions. And, you know, you and I are just out there trying to make the world a better place. And this is just one way to do it.
Well, I so appreciate you taking the time to share your knowledge and experience with us. And for everyone listening, you can find all the resources, show notes, everything mentioned here today over at bonecoach.com/ Dr. Jen Simmons, breast cancer, osteoporosis. I want to thank you again so much for your time. We'll see you in the next episode. Hope you found this episode of the Bone Coach Show helpful. You can find all the resources, show notes, everything mentioned over at bonecoach.com. If you enjoyed this episode and found it helpful, be sure to share it with someone you love, a friend, family member, even a group of people. And also be sure to hit that subscribe button so you never miss an episode that can help you improve your bones, your health, and your future. One last reminder, if you haven't done so already, head over to bonecoach.com. for more great resources to help you get on the path to stronger bones and an active future. I'm your Bone Coach, Kevin Ellis. I'll see you in the next episode.